Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Interlude Theatre/Attempt. Please welcome the man who's had to deal with his son's dirty protest. It's Richard Herring!
Thank you! Ah, hello Norwich! At last! At last I'm here. This gig has been cancelled twice, postponed twice, for some reason. I don't know what's been going on. But now here we are, finally. We've made it. It's August 2021. We were meant to be here in, I think, April 2020, first of all. But love to be here. Welcome to Richard Herring's lovely sturdy tent podcast. Though I was hanging out at the Northwick Wizard Maze today, and for people at home, that is a real thing. Sounds like I've made that up. And some 13-year-old boys with flick knives right in the middle said they call it Rahalastapa. And then they took all my sandwiches. So it's been nice to be here. Yeah. I love the distinction of North Norfolk. That's what I like. Fuck South Norfolk. That's what I say. Fuck them, eh? South. You know what I call South Norfolk? Suffolk. That's what I call it. I read in the local newspapers. I'm going to have a go at South Norfolk. South Norfolk Council are considering selling off their HQ, aren't they? Have you read that in the paper? It's my topical... Norfolk basement. Good, sell it off. You don't need it, mate, because it's not a place. Yeah. This is where it's at. And I've been on holiday. I'm going on holiday again next week. I've had 2 holidays in the UK. I went to Somerset to see my folks. It was my dad's 85th birthday at the beginning of this month. And We went round, and they haven't seen the kids obviously much over the last couple of years. And my three-year-old son was there, and he got quite excited, and he was playing in the garden. He started covering himself in mud, and my wife was all like, "Oh, sorry, Barbara." That's my mum saying, "Sorry, Barbara. This is very..." my mum was going, "No, it's just lovely to see them. Don't worry about it. It's lovely. It doesn't matter what they do. It's lovely to see them." And she remembered that when I'd been about three or four, there's a photo of me all covered in mud. So she thought, it's all, you know, like father, like son, it's fine. And he was excited about that. Then we gave him a bath. Seriously, it was just a bath full of mud, basically. And I gave him a shower. It was quite good fun because I gave him a shower. He was still wearing his pants. And then after the shower, I took his pants off to dry him. And there was just, his pants were full of mud. His little willy was just covered in mud. We all had a good laugh. It's all right. It's all right to laugh at a three-year-old boy's willy. That's okay if it's your own child. So he got excited. He was enjoying all the laugh. Then he was outside and he was naked because all his clothes had got wet and they'd been spraying stuff around. So he was running around naked, which is fine. And then he said, "I'm going to do a wee." And everyone laughed. He did a wee and everyone was laughing. He did a wee in the bush. And then he said, "I'm going to do a poo." And he's very private usually. He has to do, "I'm doing a poo, shut the door." And we thought he was joking. Then he started squatting down, started doing a poo. I said, no, you can't do a poo. And my wife was getting all upset about it. I sort of chased him and he ran off and I could see this poo starting to come out of him. Then he got on the patio and pooed, just did it and let it go on the patio. My wife was mortified and was going, "It's okay, it's just great to see them." It's lovely. So that was a lot of fun, but it's good because I'm writing a sitcom for Radio 4 Relativity. That's an episode sorted out. So yeah, it's good. I'll play him this when he's 18. I'll play him this episode. We'll joke about it all the time, though. By the end of the week, he sort of thought, I think he just got, he got laughs for everything, and he thought, where can I go from? And I've been in that position. Where can I go? You've seen some of the disasters that have happened to me on this stage, not this particular one, but you know, you're going a certain distance, you've got to push it a bit further. And then he thought he'd get, everyone would laugh again and just. And he said, "I know, I won't do it again." He said after 2 days. Ah, little prick. Right, so what else have I got for you? Look, I'll crack on, I think, because make a note of when we started a bit late, didn't we? So we've got a bit of time. Right, my guest this week, very excited. I'm so glad to be here in Norwich. You know, I love Norwich and North Norfolk so much. I hate. I'm raising money for, you may be aware, I had a problem this year when I had an operation, so part of my body is gone. I'm not going to tell you which one if you don't know. So I'm raising money. I'm running a half marathon in November for the North and East Hertfordshire NHS. And I just like the fact I'm not doing it for the South and West. I fucking hate the South and West. Welland Garden City, that's the centre of Hertfordshire. They can fuck off. It's good, isn't it, to just divide up a county. Let's divide everything. That's what we've done in this country. Anyway, let's crack on. Justgiving.com/monoball if you would like to sponsor me. My guest this week, he's probably best known for being Beard of the Year 2011. That's right. 10 long years ago since his beard was celebrated. I think it's the beard on his face. I don't think he's been living with either a gay man or a gay woman, I can't work out. We'll find out anyway, because we'll talk to him about it. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the amazing Jay Rayner! Jay Rayner, come in. Sit down. Jay Rayner.
Do you want to know about Beard of the Year?
I do want to know everything about Beard of the Year.
All right, so I beat Brian Blessed.
Wow.
And Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And
wow. He's got a messy beard. That should never be up for him.
No, I mean, frankly, I'm a fraud. But here's what happened. It's run by this guy who runs the Beard Liberation Front, obviously. And he had moved Beard of the Year online onto Twitter. And I just noticed that he'd announced the shortlist, which was me, Brian, and Rowan. I feel I can be on first name terms as we're in competition. And I thought, fuck, I can take this, because the Archbishop of Canterbury is not going to have a big Twitter following, and nor is Brian Blessed. So I swung.
Yeah.
I swung my bigger Twitter following behind, and I took it. So yeah. Beard of the Year is mine. I'm a bit of a fraud.
Out of those three,
yeah,
I think the other two have just got very hairy faces. You've made an effort.
Well, it's trimmed.
Yeah,
it's detailed.
Yeah,
there's detailed.
You shave around there. Yes, yeah, no, just doesn't.
Look at these. They're very. Look at my hands.
Yes,
they're very smooth.
Yeah.
I'm not a hairy man.
Okay,
this is kind of distraction.
Okay,
there you go.
For a long time, my beard only grew underneath my chin. So, like a sort of Amish.
Did you feel like you lacked definition?
It was a sort of weird thing. So I couldn't. But now it's come a little bit up here. So no,
it's fine. I don't know if Beard of the Year is still running, but yeah. I would happily nominate you if it was. Which is the kind of thing you say when you're invited on as a guest.
If you're disappointed not to have won it in any of the subsequent years, or once you've won, is that it?
I think that's it, really. Yeah. It's like, do you know Rear of the Year is still going?
I do know. Well, we had Annika Rice, who's a previous winner of Rear of the Year.
Yeah, and Carol Vorderman has had it.
Yeah.
But I've not been up for that, which...
No. It's a bit sad. Arse of the Year.
Arse of the Year, I could tell. Arse, yeah.
Not Rear. Oh, well, look, it's terrific to meet you. I don't think we've ever met before.
Who are you?
I don't know, we've
never met before.
No, Richard,
we do not know each other. We're not showbiz pals.
We're not, but I'm not really showbiz pals with anyone. That's why this works.
Nobody likes you.
No one likes me. I like to keep myself to myself.
Yeah, sure. Just you and 300 people who have paid...
It's nice, isn't it? The tent. What do you think of the tent? It's all right.
I think your tent's fantastic.
They're a lovely audience, and you can hear them laughing. It's nice. Well done to Norwich. Mm-mm. One day they'll have buildings here. They'll be fine. And then we can... Good. Imagine that.
It'll be lovely when it's finished.
I was reading about Norwich today when I was going to write some stuff about it, and I couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
But they've got the hand of some... Have you seen there's a museum with the hand of some guy that's been cut off in a duel about 500 years ago? They've still got his hand in the museum. His mummified hand.
That's nice.
Yeah. And there's a place that was bricked up during the plague, and they thought because everyone had died in there, and then they heard some noises and they opened it up and they found the daughter hadn't been dead.
I mean, presumably she was by the point they...
She was. She'd choked to death trying to eat her parents' leg. 1974 that happened in, so that's 1974. Good. You're a man of many talents, but I'm interested. You've got a new book out called Chewing the Fat.
I have, yes.
And in the introduction to that, you talk about how you started off in journalism and then
I still am in journalism.
Yeah, but you started.
I am in journalism.
But you were seeing yourself as a journalist who might be doing serious stories, and which you were doing, and then you were offered to be a restaurant critic, and you thought you'd do it for a little bit, but then go back to proper journalism.
Proper journalism, as I said pompously.
Yeah. And that's kind of interesting that you thought that you obviously clearly don't think it anymore.
I thought... So I got the gig in 1999, and people often say, how do I become a restaurant critic? I didn't ever think of doing this job until about 3 seconds after the editor of The Observer, then editor of The Observer magazine, had said, the current restaurant critic is moving off to be TV critic. I went, I could do that. and I thought, when I got to 2009, 10 years. 10 years, good run, 10 years.
Yeah.
And my other half looked at me and went, nah, you won't quit. And I didn't. And 11 years further, 12 years on, I'm still doing it.
Yeah.
And that's not a very good story. It's just a proof of endurance.
But you don't want to go, but that's obviously a choice. So you've decided, you no longer see it,
I think what happened was that as the job developed, obviously I go to restaurants and I write about them. But actually I got more interested in the way food reaches into every aspect of our lives.
Yeah.
It's not just about how things taste. It's about emotions and memories and sex and relationships and politics and economics, and you can track wars around the flow of food. Most of Brexit was about food. Most of COVID was about food. It just reaches into everything. So actually, I just really stayed a reporter and a journalist.
Yeah.
And alongside the restaurant writing and the witty bon mot about, the lemon sole being overcooked and all that, carried on writing that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Because I think when I started out, my ideal job would have been TV critic, just because it'd be cool to be paid just to sit at home and watch TV. That's what I thought,
yeah.
And it was showing my mum and dad that I hadn't wasted my time watching TV for all my teenage years. But I did try to become a TV critic, but again, I was too young to do it. Is it a dream job in that way, in that you're eating out in restaurants all the time, or is
If you like restaurants, then obviously it's a good gig.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to complain about the fact that I am paid to sit in restaurants and then go home and write smart-ass things about them. What I would say is that I am not paid for what I eat. I am paid for what I write.
Yeah.
And I can get quite significantly masturbatory about the business of writing that column and what it takes and why it's not simply about using words like the wife plumped for the steak. There's something really weird in local newspaper restaurant reviews. Everybody's plumping for things.
Yeah.
Constant plumping. I've never used the word, but for some reason that verb, to plump, appears in these reviews. You've got to work out what the story is every single time. My job is to make you read until the end of my column and not click anywhere else on the screen or turn the page to the gardening column until I'm done. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm paid for.
Sure. And so, like, I just want to ask some obvious questions sure you get asked. Do you pay for the meals or do they give you the meals for free?
The Observer pays for them at second hand, as in I pay for them on my credit card and then they reimburse me. We don't accept comps of any kind.
Okay.
And if they try to send me freebies, I send them back because I'm that moral a human being.
Now, the main question, how authentic a restaurant experience do you think you're capable of having, given that people must know that you're a restaurant critic?
They don't know I'm coming until I arrive because I book under a pseudonym.
Okay.
That's a fun game. I turn up. The thing is, restaurants are like theatre. You know, all the work is done before the audience arrives.
Okay.
They can't change their ingredients just because I've walked through the door. They can't retrain their staff. They can't make their cooking better. I mean, they can try and give me more attention, but I can notice what's going on. I'm not stupid.
Yeah.
So the line is, I'm yet to find a terrible restaurant that suddenly becomes a terrific one because I arrive. You can see what's going on.
Yeah.
And they will try things on. My life's hell because they keep trying to send me freebies. Or the classic one is the bill arrives. Most people, if they've got a problem with the bill, it's because it includes things they didn't have and is therefore more expensive than they think it should be. With a restaurant critic, it's more likely, and it's happened many, many times, that the bill will be missing something they did have.
Right.
And have to send the bill back to get them to put stuff on. Because they're trying to make the experience look cheaper than it actually is.
Yeah, of course. And you're not paying for it, are you? So,
well,
is there a point where the Observer will go, we're not paying you for that bottle of wine that you spent £10,000 on?
I work on the premise that if you want to keep this job, do not take the piss.
Okay.
Because you do not want the expenses department, whoever signs them, to call you up and say, what happened here?
Yeah.
There was a review of mine, which was quite famous, if such a thing can be, which was of Le Cinq in Paris, which is a Michelin 3-star. Okay. And it was a shitbagging because it was horrible in every way and I was angry and I was cross. But I knew it was going to be extraordinarily expensive. It was €630 for two. Mm. My companion paid her bill and I paid half of mine, so the paper actually only paid €150. Okay. I'm sitting on one. When's this going out? It's not for a couple of weeks.
A couple of weeks, yeah.
A couple of weeks, okay. Yeah. I'll give you a preview. I have promised to be positive for the past 18 months.
Yes.
I didn't think people wanted to read negative reviews. But it was always going to end sometime, wasn't it? And that sometime is this Sunday.
Right.
Where I came across a restaurant. Don't tweet this. Keep it to yourself. I came across a restaurant. It was the wine list I found. And I've just written a piece, and that's been out this week, which was about the cheapest price, the opening price of a bottle of wine, and how it's crept up to like £30, £32, £35. Well, in this place, in fact, I won't name it, so we can keep it down, keep some of the mystique.
Yeah.
The opening price is £84 for a bottle of wine that retails at £13. So it's a markup of a factor of six. And I decided I could be professionally angry.
Yes.
So I'm very angry. The bill is £370, and I haven't yet broken it to the editor to try and work out whether I can get it all back. But I'm willing to take the hit because, fuck me, they deserve it.
Yeah. That's good. Well, it's good that someone who knows, because most people go and my dad always chooses the
second cheapest bottle of wine.
Second cheapest.
Yeah.
And was actually...
So do I.
When we were back with him, was complaining my he'd been to the restaurant with my sister and she'd wanted a glass of champagne and then they'd all said they'd have one and she'd chosen a specific champagne and then my dad was going to pay for it and said, get a bottle because we're all going to have it. And the bottle was £65 for champagne, which I didn't mean to, want to tell him wasn't that expensive.
I'm sorry, no, not really. I did, in this place, get the second cheapest bottle of wine and that was £90.
Okay. So it's good to see someone who knows the facts.
Well, I mean, actually, it was more the case that when I saw those prices, I thought, well, maybe I should go and look.
Yeah.
Because if those bottles of wine retail at 30 quid, 35 quid, then as painful it is, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
But it seemed unlikely to me, and lo and behold, they were 13 quid bottles of wine.
See, I mean, I like going to posh restaurants. I don't go to posh restaurants very much, and I always feel, you know, it takes too long to get over the guilt of spending that kind of money on stuff.
No, I find that really easy. I mean, look, actually, to be quite serious about it, people imbue certain things with money. For example, Richard.
Yes.
How much is your suit?
It was expensive.
And how much was your suit, Richard? Go on.
It was £2,000.
Fuck me! How could you spend £2,000? Now, I've done
because
that.
I'm not going to shit it out late in 4 hours' time.
But eventually.
I'm going to wear it 200 times.
The point is that there are a lot of people who'd say, well, why didn't you just go to M&S and get a reasonable one for £159? Yeah. £30 extra for the waistcoat. And it's about what we attach value to. And there's a particular issue in this country with attaching value to food. So, you know, nobody thinks there's anything wrong with spending £500 on tickets in a weekend to see your team lose in the Premier League.
Yeah.
But they do have a problem with it when you do it around food. And they're both about memories. Yeah. They're simply it's about what you attach value to. And if it's crap, then it will make me cross. But if it's great, and there have been things that I spent a lot of money on which were fantastic.
Yeah.
And you go, well, that was worth it because I'll always have that memory, whereas you might grow out of that suit.
Well, I did for a couple of years.
I know.
But now I'm back in it.
Yeah.
Thanks to cancer. It's all good news. But
I have cancer because I could really... No, thanks.
But in a way, yeah. Overcharging at restaurants is because you want to, in a way, if you're going to one of those posh restaurants, isn't it about spending way too much money to, you know...
No, it's not about spending way too much money. You know, the experience can be worth what they're charging for it. And if the bottle of wine, you know, there is going to be markup because you're not doing the washing up, you're not carrying it from the kitchen, you're not storing that bottle, you're not... You know, bringing out the lovely glassware, you're not doing all that stuff, putting you in a room with central heating and staff and plumbing and everything. So if that bottle of wine had been £30, £35 and charged at 90, it would have been fine and reasonable. Same token with ingredients, and you've got skilled people doing stuff to them. It can be worth it.
Yeah.
But if you don't attach value to it, and you clearly don't, I just think you should stop going.
Okay.
I don't think it's making you happy. I think it's, you know, the after effect is just guilt.
Yeah.
And
my wife really likes going to places like that. Though,
so. Oh, well, there's a really good, you know, dynamic there.
Yeah.
You going there, making her happy, but then feeling guilty.
I feel guilty for a bit, and then it's all right.
Is it?
Yeah.
And then you shit it out,
then
fine.
Then I do a shit and think, that's the most expensive shit I've ever done.
Expensive.
Wait till I show my son.
I'll
just show him how to do an expensive shit. His shit was probably made of fish fingers and... That's a 50p shit he's done.
Well, is that because you're feeding him lower grade stuff than you're willing to feed yourself?
Absolutely.
You're basically bargain basement for the small children
of course.
Who are growing.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. I'll take him that place with the expensive wine instead. That's fine.
Yep.
The book's really great. One of my favourite things about it is it's very short.
Yes.
I like it. I've done a short book myself. David Beale's book was very short. It's good.
Yeah,
it's good to be. I'm listening on audiobook to Wolf Hall.
That's long.
It's 17, 18 hours long.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to get through that
rubbish.
I enjoyed being able to read your book in a day, which is it's good if you're doing a podcast about it.
Yeah, helps.
Not even a day. But I was interested in. I used to write a column for the Metro, as I mentioned, you backstage. But it's the same length, 600 words, which I think is each piece of yours is 600 words, which I think is a really.
It's an extraordinarily tight discipline. Yeah. I don't think, you know, writers, journalists should really show their workings in the margins too often.
Yeah.
But you know that... So basically, this book is a collection of my OFM columns, my Observatory Monthly columns, the ones which aren't time-tagged and ranting about David Cameron putting his cock in a pig's mouth or whatever, because there was one of those. But it didn't make the book. And each one, you have to be absolutely clear what the point of it is, and you have to get in and get out very cleanly and be as entertaining as you possibly can along the way.
Yeah.
It has to be sharp and tight, and it's the hardest column I have to write, but it's also the most sort of rewarding.
Sure. And you can get a lot in. You get a lot in. Sometimes you read one of those and go, God, that was only, if that was only 600 words, there was, you know, it's like when you see the American sitcoms that are 22 minutes long and they've somehow done three plot strands and you go, how the hell did they get all that in? When it's written well, and I think it is a good length. It's a good length as a reader. I think it's a very good discipline.
I said at the end, I've had to take it out. We're going to serialise it in the Observer because it's a, you know, Observer copy, but and they told me to take it out. I point out that it is, each column is exactly, there's going to be a theme here tonight, exactly the right length for the bog.
Right.
It's a perfect toilet book.
Yeah.
That's where it should live. And I assume that that's basically how you did the research for this, through 40 visits to the bog.
You're very right.
Yeah.
Very much correct.
And now you associate me. Sorry, that's my own thousand yard stare. We do.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, we're sort of basically the same age, right? You're about 10 months older than me. I think you're born in 66.
I'm 66.
I'm
16.
I'm July.
Well, I'm not 60. I was born in 66.
It's soon as we will be 66.
And we have similarish hair.
Similarish hair?
Well, are you really 10 months younger than me?
Yeah. Right,
okay. Come on. I get accused of dyeing this, which I do not do. Right. I point out that you've got the white in the beard, but the rest of it's just the way it is.
Yes. Well, mine's going all the way down.
Is it?
My whiteness, yeah. I've got chest hairs. I think I wrote...
Do you have to clip things now? Like hair?
I've had my testicle removed. Just don't bring it... Yeah, I had to have that clipped off.
You see, obviously, it's been a trauma for you, but it's also the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it? It's like... gallons of material from one testicle.
Yeah, well, not anymore. I can tell you that. It wasn't doing too well before. It wasn't doing too well. Don't think anyone's noticing. That could be on a little... When you get to the restaurant, there's a little spoon with something on it. You go, yeah. I could do one of those.
But do you remember have you ever seen the film version? It's in the book as well, but of Hannibal, the follow-up to Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
Which includes the character played by Ray Liotta in the movie getting a very delicate full frontal lobotomy.
Yes.
And what was brilliant about it, there was a lot of talk about it in the food world, as to how absolutely perfect the culinary approach to scooping out little quenelles of brain while the patient was still alive, putting them in acidulated water, then frying them in butter, then feeding them back to him. Absolutely perfect. I mean, not to be recommended.
No.
And, you know, not to be on anybody's menu.
No.
Apart from Fergus Henderson's. But just really, anyway.
I guess it makes it more difficult to write about the experience afterwards if they're taking bits of your brain off.
If you get the language sentence, you're screwed.
And there's that when they used to suck. There was that guy who thought he could treat mental illness by sucking the hypothalamus of the brain out, and it just obliterates all short-term memories. Think,
nice.
Yeah. So that
is that. Is that an amuse-bouche or a starter or a main course? What do you think?
Well, it's
or
he
dessert.
He used a straw. Took it. I don't think he ate it.
Oh, he spat.
I think he spat it.
He didn't swallow.
I think he did. It's a famous case. Look it up. It's awful.
Yeah.
Anyway, because we're a similar age, there's a lot of things that are... My main takeaway was the spilling food down myself, which I do all the time. That's why I've changed. I ate a bacon sandwich in the car.
I came up to Norwich earlier on today because I thought I'd combine it with a review. I'm not saying... I'd have to kill you if I told you where.
Okay.
And I didn't in there, but I toyed with bringing a second shirt
for
fear of spillage at lunch.
Yeah.
But I lived, you know, I was going to wear a white shirt and then I went, no, just wear this colour shirt and nobody will notice.
That's true.
That's the solution.
Has that always been the case? It seems it's always...
Yes.
I think it has been for me as well. The good thing about having young kids is I can go, oh, bloody...
Yeah, mine are 17, 22, they're not spitting food out.
It's never my kids.
Well, they're, you know, they're, we... when they get to that age, you always have that, oh, God, clean the vomit up and see if you can get them into bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. every parent has been there. But so, yeah, no, it's always been the case.
Yeah.
My late mother literally did it all the time, but she had a shelf. Well, I want to say she had a shelf, which kind of excused it, and I don't. Well, I do. Look, I like to think it's an expression of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
That those, you know, you see these people get up from the table and they look as crisp and as white and like a snowfield as they did when they sat down. You think, well, you just didn't fucking like your dinner, did you? You didn't like it enough. That's why, and that's why I am covered in dribbles of gravy.
Yeah. When there's just food all over my half of the table when I go to a restaurant, which I've felt bad about until now.
But no, don't now feel bad about that. That's what good people
do. I feel
do.
That's okay.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So let's talk about your mum quickly, because Claire Rayner, who, again, my generation will...
Yeah.
Massively remember as...
And then anybody who's, you know, under the age of about 35 won't have a fucking clue. yeah, she was an agony aunt, a sex advice columnist. That's an interesting childhood. And it was. I mean, you know, it was a family business. Yeah. 1,000 letters came into the house every week. 1,000 went out again with advice.
Right.
When there were... Occasionally, she'd advertise a leaflet on the page if you thought there was a problem everybody had. And they had to be... All the... You'd get 10,000 requests for it, and every letter had to be opened, and the covering letter read to see if there was any other issue,
right.
And then the leaflet sent out. And this was perfect pocket money job for a 10-year-old. no, seriously, at the age of 10, I knew uses for natural yogurt, which had nothing to do with food. And there was another one. You know, I could spot the symptoms of the menopause at 50 paces as a 10-year-old. Useless then, became much more useful later on. It was that sort of thing. Yeah. There was one called "Why Can't We Make Love Anymore?"
Right.
Which was a very detailed description of how to rekindle lovemaking. You know, 10 years old. It's great.
Have you got any copies of that left?
I'll give you notes.
Okay, afterwards. Thank you.
And there was one that sort. I mean, I've told this before, but I have to tell it again. There was a guy, all the posts came to the house, and one morning my mum received this cardboard box at the breakfast table. And she opened it up and looked a bit sort of startled. And it transpired there was a man somewhere in Middle England who was concerned about the shape of his erection. So we're talking like 78, 79, and he'd had to think about how he could get advice on this and decided that the available technology, a Polaroid, was not the way to go. So he wasn't going to send Claire Rayner a dick pic. Instead... He carved it lovingly from wood. He sanded it, painted it all the right colours, as far as he was concerned, and varnished it, and sent it to my mum. Lent slightly to one side, but apart from that, it was absolutely fine.
Right.
And it became a bit of a money earner, because come 1982, 83, Safe Sex, Claire is asked on to BBC Breakfast Television to demonstrate how to use a condom. The contract for that went up on the wall in the bog. Claire Rayner, for services, used a condom. And so she got this thing. She had the perfect thing. So she, 8:15 in the morning. When she finally died in 2010, my brother got it out on the pulpit as an example of what our childhood had been. And in truth, I think it's the closest thing we've got to a family heirloom. Still there.
But she was she was a very popular figure on TV, and there was a puppet of her on Spitting Image.
Oh shit, yes, there was. We tried to bid for that when they came out for sale, but we were outbid. Really? Somebody. I mean, a bit weird, I end up thinking.
Yeah.
That you wanted it more than her own kids did. We didn't go very far. I think we put a price of about 400 quid on my mother's Spitting Image puppet.
Right. Was it weird to have your mum on Spitting Image as a young man?
Well, it was, because it went out when I was in the first year at Leeds University in 1984.
Right.
And to watch telly in those days, you had to go to a communal room. And Spitting Image was, I had no idea, and then that turned up. And I suddenly stood up in front of the screen and said, "You fucking bastard!" Everybody's looking at me because I've been trying not to let on that I might be the son of somebody. It was a weird moment.
Yeah.
I shouted at the television and then looked sheepish and left.
See, I don't know. I don't know if I would have liked it. I think I'd have found it kind of funny. But
well, it was funny and odd, but also, you know, it was a childhood of enormous privilege and got to meet really interesting people and, you know, filthy conversations were a constant round our house. Una Stubbs was a friend of my mother because of what she did.
Yeah.
I don't know what the connection was, but there you go. just died yesterday. When we were recording. No, it was a great childhood. And it had its odd bits to it, but I can't complain about the immense privilege of growing up with the rewards that brought her and the interesting people I met.
Sure. Funnily enough, we tried to bid on a Spitting Image puppet as well.
Of whom?
It was a Michael Winner, but the reason was me and Stuart, it was sort of in the early 90s, I think they were selling them all. But the Michael Winner puppet looked really like our manager, John Foday. So we were kept on bidding. No one was bidding on it. It was like £100. We spent £100, and then someone bid against us, and we bid like £150. I think we might have gone up to about £300.
And then that's enough.
And then you know who was bidding on the Michael Winner puppet?
Michael Winner. I liked Michael Winner. We politically, nothing in common.
Yeah.
And he was ludicrous, but he was brilliantly ludicrous. I came across him once, showbiz story. I came across him once in the Wolseley, and there's a U-shaped element in the middle, which is basically where you want to be. If you're outside the horseshoe, you're in Siberia.
Okay.
And I'm sitting at a table in the horseshoe. Of course I fucking am. And Michael Winner is standing over a table with a tape measure out, measuring the table.
Right.
And I go, "Michael, what are you doing?" He said, "Well, my usual table wasn't ready," they said. "So they gave me this one. They said it was the same size, but it fucking isn't." he carried a tape measure with him to check the size of tables.
It's important.
And I think, you know, I've not really put my back into it until I've done that.
Oh, well, that's good. It's good to know. Yeah, you'd see him around London every now and again, Michael Winner.
The other thing that was great about him was, as a young journalist, I often had to try and get hold of famous people for quotes for pieces that I was writing. And you'd have to go through agents and assistants. And no, you just phone Michael Winner. And he'd put it, "Winner!" And he'd go, "Hello, Mr. Winner." And he'd answer you. And he'd go, "Is that enough?" He'd go, "Yes, thank you." And then he'd hang up. Great.
Cool.
I loved him for that.
Would you do that for a young journalist if they rang you now?
If they got my number, I'd be deeply disturbed as to how that happened.
I've got it. I can give it out.
I try to answer every single email without being too facetious.
Yeah. Well, if you know, you've had that example of being a young
Most of the time, I get a lot of I get a lot of emails from people saying, "I like food. I'd like to be a restaurant critic. How do I do it?" And you go, "Well." And then I wrote a letter, which I now email back to all of them, which explains the mechanics of journalism careers.
Is it "Wait for me to die"?
Yes. It has the words, "Prize my cold, dead hands off this job."
I think it's fascinating to read your book and the stuff you've written about food, obviously, as well, just because you are such an expert on it. You know, I like food, but I don't think I think about it at all, and I certainly don't. I like the bits in your book where you talk about liking burnt stuff, because that's what I like. I just had a very burnt bacon sandwich.
Oh, well, that was... Was it really good?
Yeah, it was. It was disgustingly bad, but it was good.
I mean, that column arose specifically because I do like burnt toast. I've always liked the flavour of burnt toast.
Too.
Burnt toast, butter and Marmite. It's a kind of triple lock thing.
That's what I like.
And one of my sons just looked at me and said, "If only people knew." And I thought, he's right. And actually, it was a point. I thought the only way through this is to confess all my filthy food sins. So the only thing you can be humiliated by or outed by is those things you refuse to admit to.
Yeah.
So I wrote the whole column about my filthy food sins and started off with burnt toast. And it ended up, came out, and about a week later, I went to the local impeccably middle-class farmer's market near us in Herne Hill, South London, to the bread stall. And the guy behind the stall said, "Would you like a dark one or will you burn it yourself?" Which I thought was good.
Well, it's good, but you obviously care. I mean, I don't think... I was talking to the off-menu guys quite recently as well, and they care so deeply about the food and finding the best food, and I just don't have that.
Well, they do, but let's just point out that in their podcast, it's an imaginary restaurant...
Yeah.
And in my podcast, it's an actual fucking restaurant. And they care up to a point, but they don't put their back into it of booking a restaurant.
Well, they don't want to pay out any money.
Exactly.
That's the problem.
Well, no, we don't pay any money either. But you go to the trouble of putting people together with the right restaurant and putting microphones over the top. Whereas I think we all know James and Ed basically turn up having done no research apart from how to make the best sound of a genie.
I think
I'm just
that's true.
Jealous as hell.
I'm jealous of them as well. And, they're quite funny as well.
Let's not overstate it.
But, I think your podcast, you're a very good interviewer, I think. So, because it's not so much about the food. The food's part of it.
The food is merely a vehicle. Sometimes we get people, PRs, are saying, your food podcast. Well, it's not. It takes place at a restaurant. What was interesting about it, about Out to Lunch, available wherever you get your podcast. I wasn't entirely convinced when it was first put to me as an idea. And then it was literally the very first one we did, which is Richard E. Grant. We put up the microphones in a restaurant.
He did.
Have you ever had him on?
Yes.
Have you? Why have I never heard that?
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know why. I decided.
Why have I never heard that?
I decided not to put it out. I didn't think he was a big enough star for the microphone.
That's slightly surprising. He loved mine, and that went out. We had a really good conversation, and we saw eye to eye on a lot of things. And he told me all about, a whole bunch of stuff which you might want to listen to if you feel robbed of a podcast with Richard E. Grant because one hasn't been released. I have one. Anyway, we put up the microphones over the top. I completely forgotten about that. And as the food started to arrive, it became clear that he'd sort of forgotten the process that we were involved in and just started to talk.
Right.
Also helped that he'd been through therapy. My ideal guest has been through therapy because they have a particular language which helps them to just... access all that stuff. And as long as you've done the research, properly done the research. I mean, you'll see what you can't see on a podcast, you're sitting here with a notebook and you've done research.
Yeah.
Just winging it. And there is a lot of winging it in podcasts, which pisses me off. But if you know how to direct the conversation, you can get something. And if you know how to interview Richard E. Grant, you can get a spectacular episode out of him.
I mean, I got a very good episode out of him. Just no one's allowed to. It was genuinely one of the top five, I think.
Was it?
For me, I thought it was...
Top three, top five?
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. You know, that's not including today.
No, of course.
We haven't finished.
This one's not been ranked yet.
Yeah, so I can't rank it.
How does it rank against all the ones you haven't been able to put out?
Well, there's been two others I haven't put out.
Okay.
One was because Michael Evis didn't understand what a podcast was. And wanted so much cut out that he'd said that it wouldn't, there was
no longer
there was nothing left in it. Because there was a running joke about something that he then said, "Oh, we can't do that." And I said, "Don't worry about it." It was quite good, but it wasn't that good. And there was Ricky Wilson from the Kaiser Chiefs, which was not a very good podcast, which I elected to not put out.
I've got one that didn't go out because after we recorded it with this particular person, I won't name. They made headlines by suddenly being anti-Semitic.
Okay.
So I thought, fuck you, the revenge of the Jew on you is not to broadcast this hour and a half of your time.
Did he not realise when you were talking to him?
Well, they didn't do it during the podcast. they kept their overt anti-Semitism hidden. Actually, the only thing is they probably would say, well, I'm not an anti-Semite, I'm just a very left-wing... Anyway, okay. Let's not go there.
Let's not go there. Well, it's the fun... It's good. It's good to know that they cannot go out, because then you've got to come and see them live just in case. I reckon this one's going out, though.
You think?
Yeah. We're going to have to do something pretty bad. I could be anti-Semitic.
And then, that would be
I could give it
that
a
would
go.
Be self-sabotaging to quite an extraordinary degree. But, I mean, it depends. I mean, deep down, Richard, do you hate Jews? I mean, it's the question I don't think you've been asked enough. Or I wouldn't, do you have a problem?
I wouldn't even say deep down.
Deep down. Is it right there on the surface?
Right at the top, just always bubbling to come out, but...
Is it just like at the back of your throat, just on the edge of your lips? Yeah, well, you're here, and, you know...
But that's why your podcast is good, not because you're Jewish, but because because you do. That's what that's is 100%. It's you know stuff as this norm with Omid, and you're reeling off the date of his live at the Apollo, so you'd absolutely know everything about more than the guest knows sometimes. And I think as a interviewee, it's quite rare unless you're a big star. Yeah. You interviewed a lot by people who
there
have
is,
no idea.
There is a moment when I've seen it happen with Out to Lunch quite a lot, where the guest suddenly visibly relaxes because they think, oh, this person has actually read the book, done more research than normal, and can reel off dates and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not hard.
It's not hard.
It just takes a bit of time.
I mean, I think if you're doing like a daily show on the radio and you meet 20 people, you can't read all the books. But you can read more than the press release.
Yes, you can.
And just work out who the person
and
is.
And I'm kind of, I'm interested in that stuff. Yeah. I've written profiles for The Observer for a very long time anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not particularly different. It's just, I've got to have lunch with my guests for sometimes up to 2 hours.
Right.
And often I actually have to come to a way to stop the recording. With James May, it was just going on and on. It was all great. But I could see the look of terror on the producer's face because they had to edit this.
Yeah.
And so I brought it to an end before we actually got to dessert because it was just too much. But my fear is I'm having lunch with them for such a long time that I'll run out of things to talk to them about. So do the research and then you won't.
Well, or have some emergency questions and then... And
I thought you'd never ask them.
I have to ask you this one. I was trying to think of what the food ones were. Would you rather, and I haven't asked this for ages, would you rather have a hand made out of ham? It's good to come out of the provinces. They're easily pleased. You can't do this stuff in London.
Yeah.
Or an armpit that dispenses sun cream, so half of it's food. So you've got a hand.
Yeah.
You can
made out of ham.
Yeah, you can choose the ham, and you could choose a fancy ham.
Yeah. Well, as everybody should know, I'm a non-observant Jew, and I don't hold with the god of picky eating.
No.
So I've no issue with the ham.
No.
But the hand made out of ham seems to have less utility than the armpit which dispenses sun cream.
What about being able to eat ham anytime you want? You can eat
it. Well, is it restorative ham?
Yeah.
I mean, it'll grow regrows.
Back. It'll grow back like fingernails. It'll take about a month. If you ate the whole thing, you wouldn't have a hand for a month.
And I get to choose.
You get to choose
whether it's a Wiltshire ham or a ham on Iberico or.
Yeah, you can have any ham you want.
And do you smell on a daily basis of ham?
Yeah, of course. You've got a hand made out of ham.
But then
I don't know if you made that clear.
Vagrant dogs running after you in search of wanting to eat your hand. And then you have
rapper
canine back. Spittle when they because at some point you'll have to sacrifice a middle finger to the to the ravaging hordes.
Could wrap a plastic bag around it.
Yeah. I mean, I'll have the hand of ham.
It works as a hand as well.
Yeah, the hand of ham.
Yeah. You're not worried about sun cream.
No, I'm not.
Good.
I'm quite swarthy. It's because I'm a Jew.
I had no idea. Yeah. I wouldn't have had you on if I'd known. If only I'd done my research properly. I'll ask you some new emergency questions that aren't... Well, they might be about food. I don't know what they are. I've written a new book as well.
Have you?
It's so new that it's only on my iPad. It's not even a book yet. But I've got the draft. It's going to take ages.
This is exciting, isn't it? Come and sit in a tent and watch a man play with his iPad.
Look, the first one is about fruit food.
Okay.
If you had to be a piece of fruit, what kind of fruit would you rather be out of all the fruits? had to be.
It was
a piece
late,
wasn't
it? How many pages is this book?
It's 224 pages, but there's. It's
I think you should make it 223. If I'm really honest.
It's one question a page.
Yeah. I'm immediately drawn to the banana.
Okay.
But you never know what might happen to it on route, and that could be a fun adventure.
Yeah. Okay. I've got another one about food. They're all about food. I've got a weird relationship. Well,
it makes you feel guilty.
Yeah.
You're obsessed with the digestive element to food, but you're putting it into your emergency questions.
Putting into my emergency questions. I kind of love food, but I hate it because it makes me overweight, and then I stop eating all the things I like. Is that a healthy way to go?
No.
It turns out it is healthy because you lose loads of weight.
Are you getting at me?
I'm getting at myself. I'm getting it all.
Yeah, but I feel like I'm collateral damage.
You're the same as me in that.
Am I?
Yeah, in that sense. In that, 2 years ago I was thin. Then 1 year ago I was not thin, and now I'm thin.
I've had a hip issue.
Yes,
I had to have it replaced, and that took me out of my gym habit because I was.
I had a testicle removed. So I know.
Can I point out you're not the only person who's ever had an operation or had an anaesthetic. I was given a ceramic hip.
Right.
I am now part man, part crockery.
I mean, that sounds. It sounds like they were playing a joke on you. Sounds like you've been pranked.
I've seen it.
Let's replace it with something more fragile than a hip.
I was given... So the bloke who did it, this is a perfect sign of my privilege, is someone I knew when I was a public school boy when I was 16. And when you go to one of those expensive schools, you all grow up and become things. And now he's one of the foremost hip surgeons in the country. And it was, I hadn't seen him for 25 years. And I contacted him and said, could you? And it was like... It was pretty much like being 16 again, apart from the fact that he gave me a form to sign before giving me narcotics, which didn't happen when we were 16. Then he just gave them to me, but now I had to sign a form and everything. But the drugs were better.
Was it a general anaesthetic for that? Or a
no, it's an interesting one. They give you a spinal to paralyse you from the waist down and then a sedative. So it's not a general anaesthetic. It's kind of take out two bits of you. Really good. Propanol, the stuff that took out Michael Jackson. It was fantastic.
See, I was offered that. Would you have a ball removed under local anaesthetic? I mean, so you can see...
Well, I have one of your balls removed.
You could watch me.
That you could have sold tickets for. If they'd done that in here, on the stage of this tent, you could have cashed in.
Well,
I think you missed out then.
He offered me that, and I could not believe that he would think I'd want to be awake during...
But you would have been under sedation as well.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think it would... I'm not sure.
It was great sleep. It was fantastic.
Well, I liked the general anaesthetic. It's the first time I ever had it, and it was like dying.
Yeah.
And it was good. It was fine. I was cool with it. It's like I died, and then it went, bring him back
good.
Again.
Okay.
You're dead. Everything's over. It's nice. You just go, ah. And then, ah. Oh, where'd that go?
Right, second food emergency question. Okay.
Would you rather have the ability to produce honey from a special honey stomach? It would be different than your own stomach. It'd be down. So I'll tell you that later.
Bit like a stoma.
Yeah. Or be able to make a pearl in your kidney every 10 years. I've changed that question from earlier in the earlier podcast because it was in your gallbladder, and somebody told me, two people complained that the gallbladder does not connect up to the penis. Or the urethra, and so...
Medically,
it wouldn't work, and it was annoying. So it's now kidney, and that's in the book, so thank you to those people, that's changed it.
There's a very significant question I have to ask here, which is, how does the pearl reach the outside world? Do you have to pass it like you would, like
here
a kidney stone?
So I'll tell you the NBs. You would sick the honey up through your mouth, producing 1 kilogram of honey per day, which you could eat, or sell to unsuspecting members of the public. Mm.
Yeah.
Each pearl would be worth $8,000.
Yeah.
But you have to pass it with your urine via your urethra.
God. Can we do it as a vote?
I mean, ask the audience. This isn't...
Listen, it's me you're asking, so I take control of this. If you think I should take the honey, hand up. Nice. And if you think I should take the pearl out, push it out of my penis...
Every 10 years.
And I'm quite impressed by how many people actually want to see me in writhing pain.
$8,000, that's $800 a year you're making.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm worth more than that. I'll take the honey.
How much do you think you get for a kilogram of honey?
Well, there are honeys which can go... I mean, nothing like $8,000.
Right.
But
it's a kilogram per day, though, so, like, you'd be a lot
true.
Of...
That's true. I'm slightly concerned about the admin with the honey.
Yeah.
That's a lot of... I just have to go away and vomit up a lot of honey. Sorry, it's
and
a thing. And you go on a holiday and, oh, I've still got to deal with the honey. So I'm now leaning towards the pearl, which is only once every 8 years...
10 years every decade.
10 years,
you know, approximately. I don't think it would be like clockwork.
I actually think on a kind of life disturbance basis, I'm going for the pearl. Yeah, it's the pearl. Thank you.
Okay. I found another food based. So I'm just going to ask you a food based one. This is a restaurant based one.
Okay.
Would you rather be the most famous and successful person of all time, but only after you've died, or get 2-for-1 meals at Harvester for the rest of your life?
No question, I want to be the most famous person, but only after I've died.
Okay. Not a fan of Harvester?
No, I'm fine.
Have you reviewed... How many Harvesters have you actually reviewed for The Observer?
I have reviewed none because that was already done by... I think it was Adrian Gill did that.
Oh, okay.
So it didn't need me to step in. It had already been done. Cheap gag. I mean, not that I'm above a cheap gag, obviously.
Yeah.
But, okay. So...
Good. But only after you've died.
You're
happen.
Going through them and you can't find any...
All right, this has got things being consumed in it.
Yeah.
I point out this book is for all the family. There was one question I put in that my editor made me take out, thinking I'd made a mistake. I hadn't made a mistake.
Really?
I said, "Would you rather? I can't remember. Is rather be in a house that's on fire or be sucked off by a tornado?" And she said, "Oh, I thought of something a bit different. I thought that meant something a bit different." Okay, no, you were right. Would you rather have to live the rest of your life with Emu from Rod, Hull and Emu grafted onto your arm, and you have to keep him moving and reacting at all times, even when you're on your own? He can sleep when you sleep. Or have to have a full bath every day, and once it's over, have to drink all the bath water before you're allowed to do anything else? To bat, drink it.
The bath water would kill you.
Yeah.
On every day. I mean, drinking that would result in.
Emu would kill you, wouldn't he? Yeah.
That was a fucking annoying act, wasn't it?
I think it was a great act.
Yeah.
I think there's a bit of it that someone put, and I retweeted on Twitter, where he's in a supermarket and he's looking in the freezer, and Emu grabs him, and he pulls him...
Into the freezer.
Into that, but like a somersault into the freezer. It's the most extraordinary piece of slapstick I've ever seen in my life, when you consider it's just a man using his own hand to pull himself... And I met Rod Hull.
Okay.
He was on our show back in the 90s. Lucky he died. lucky for him that he died.
Did
you meet him?
I know it sounds weird. I'm not sure. Have done.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I hung around a lot of light entertainment spaces.
Yes, I bet.
Met that Jimmy Savile. A couple of times. Sorry. Went into a set. The way that Rod Hull died was so peculiar as well.
Yeah.
Falling off a roof trying to move an aerial. Mm-hmm. Given how physical a performer he was, it was just odd. But anyway, I do think the bathwater thing would kill you on the first happening.
Yeah.
And so I'm going for the Rod Hull anemia event.
That's fair enough. That's a good answer.
Thanks.
It was annoying for
not
us.
Not very funny, but...
We had a character based on Rod Hull who was someone who pretended to be Rod Hull. I'm sure I've told this story many times. But in the new series, we're going to bring him back. This morning, Rich Not Judy, and we'd recorded 6 or 7 sketches with him. Mm. Each week, he had a false arm that he refused to admit was a false arm. He didn't have Emu. And each week, he would go and do something like swimming or fencing or something, playing rugby with his false arm. And his refusal to admit that his arm was false would end up with him dying at the end of every sketch. And we were sitting on the set rehearsing the first show, and I saw someone came to the producer, who himself has now got into trouble for terrible behaviour. Funnily enough, I whispered in his ear. We saw them whispering in his ear, and then they came down and said, Rod Hull's just fallen off a roof and died, so we could, which would have been a great version of the sketch. But, I mean, we were sat, but my first thought was, oh, shit, we can't do the sketches anymore. And it's sad that Rod Hull died. He was nice. I liked him.
Did the sketch go out?
No.
At all? No.
We did right at the end of the series. We just had the pretend Rod Hull sitting by a phone going, why won't you ring? Why won't you ring? And no, he still won't.
One of the very few reviews of mine that was never published was of a restaurant called Hummus Brothers, which all it did was hummus, which I don't mind it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't very good hummus. They didn't put garlic or olive oil in the hummus because they said some people didn't like it.
Because that's not hummus.
And I made a point that if you want to know what an ingredient is like, work out which is the best, most palatable form. Because if it's deep fried, then it's not, chickpeas, the best way to eat them is deep fried as falafel. Mm. And then I had a line in there which was, frankly, even if you deep fried, David Blunkett, he would taste nice.
Okay.
And an eagle-eyed sub saw this and went away and did some searching and came back and said, do you think we should include that gag given that David Blunkett's father died in a boiling accident? And so that review never ran. I mean, actually what happened was I changed it from David Blunkett to Ann Widdecombe because there had been no boiling accident.
Are you sure?
Oh, no, we checked.
I heard her mum died.
But the review still never ran. It's the only one. And I was very grateful to the sub-editor because some jokes just aren't funny.
That's going in pretty deep.
It's going in pretty deep.
I better just check. David Blunkett hasn't got a relative who died being deep fried.
Maybe I had remembered something about poor David Blunkett's father. I don't know what it was, but that came out of the review.
Maybe. Yeah. Let me see what else. We haven't got very much. It's been so much fun already. We think we've got another 5 minutes. Then we've got to move this lot out. You'll be last week's audience. See if next week. Who's coming to the other one? Yeah, it's the same lot. Thanks for paying twice. Bang! I've hit on the. I don't know why I didn't do this before.
Yeah, you've missed a trick.
I have. I'm too nice. That's my problem. I'm a nice guy. I'm right on the road.
You don't have any questions for me. You're just flicking through the book, trying to pretend you've done research.
So, look, well, let's talk about you're into music, which I didn't know until I researched you. So you play in a...
So it's clearly a successful part of my career.
Well, I don't like music, but I'm interested. You're a man of many talents.
You're in the Taliban.
I am. What, the J. Rayner Quartet? How do the other three feel about that name?
Well, it's a fair question. And the first time we had a gig booked, they came to us and said, what are you called?
Yeah.
And I always hated those kind of jazz names. Whiplash or, the real ones, Weather Report, Shack Attack, they're all a bit weird. So the classic thing is you put your name on it. And they all just looked at me and said, well, they're not coming because our name's on, are they? So that's how it happened.
Okay.
So it's my fault.
And were they coming because your name was on there?
Absolutely, they are. Always sold out. And you will find links to all my jazz gigs on jrayner.co.uk. Fuck you.
Okay. What is it about jazz that appeals to you? Because it does not appeal to me.
Well, one of the great things, I think, of getting into something like this when you're a bit older is the realisation that you don't give a flying fuck whether someone else doesn't like it.
Okay.
And I don't. Okay. It's not my job to educate or enthuse you at all. I really love it, and all the people who love jazz like what we do, and we'll never play massive rooms. I mean, we've gone up to 600-700 seaters. If you like it, that's great. And if you don't, as I say, you'll live a pale, etiolated, impoverished life. But that's not my problem.
Okay.
I mean, I really do actually mean that I'm not on a mission to educate or enthuse anyone. If you like what we do, that's great. And if you don't, other musicians are available.
But in a way, as a critic,
yeah,
that's quite an odd way to respond, isn't it? Because you criticise other people.
Yeah, no, and I get, I've written a dozen books. I do live shows, I do jazz, and I get criticised, I get reviewed. And that's absolutely fine. And I tend to... The thing that I clocked was that if you take a very positive review seriously, as in someone says, Jay Rayner is the best thing since whatever, And if you take all that positive affirmation, then you also have to absorb all the negative. Mm-hmm. How restaurants deal with what I write is entirely up to them. But my approach to it is I may look at it and think, is this good for business or bad for business? But I desperately try not to let it impinge upon how I feel about myself.
No, it's interesting to be doing, to have two things,
two or three things. And I also think it's useful that when people say, do you know what it's like to be reviewed? No, oh, yes. You know, I've had those shitbagging book reviews, and everybody's a critic on Twitter, and there's more than enough people to tell me what a wanker they think I am, and that's fine. But when I write a restaurant review, I hope I do it with enough conviction and authority that they just have to live with it.
Yeah.
You know, if I say an £84 wine was actually £13 a bottle, I've checked.
Yeah. The thing with comedy is, regardless of the critics, you know if it's going well or not, because the audience are laughing. How do you know if you're doing jazz well or badly?
Exactly the same way. Do you keep selling tickets that people come up afterwards and tell you that I'm not buying into this at all. They tell you they enjoyed it. They applaud. Sometimes they get up and dance. Yeah. Oh yeah,
dancing
is a good sign.
It's quite hard to dance to jazz, I'd imagine. It
depends what kind of jazz you're listening to. Keep going, Richard. Dig, dig, dig.
I'm just enjoying the fact that you're slightly annoyed.
As I say, if I was making my living just from jazz, Christ, I'd make a very, very scant living. I suspect I would be desperately trying to convince you of the virtue of everything we do.
Yeah.
But I'm not.
But
it's a joyous sideline, and that's fine.
It's also true of, you know, getting a bit older as well is... You kind of, you know, you realise not everything's for everyone. It's sort of like, that's the thing with Twitter, when the people go, I don't like what you're doing. You go, okay, don't
follow me. You don't have to read. Part of the writing for The Observer, writing the Observer's restaurant column, is the comments section underneath. And I am constantly mystified by the people who turn up furious with me before they've even read a word, livid by the time they've read it, and then comment about how furious and livid they are, and you think, why are you doing this to yourself? I actually think you really like reading me and being livid, and that I'm giving you pleasure. I'm here to serve.
Yes, well, that's a good way of looking at it. And we're going to have to wrap up, but I was going to ask you a question about public school, but I will ask you it, and we'll just fuck the second audience, right? Apart from the ones who are in here already. There's sort of recently been that article about, you know, how we're governed by public school boys. Mm. It seems to me it's quite... Did you have a nice time at public school?
No, they threw me out.
Okay.
but I went to one of those, you know, I went to one of those full of high-achieving Jews.
Right.
The sort that you love. I went to the same school as David Baddiel. He was the year above me. And Sacha Baron Cohen and Matt Lucas. So, it was horrible. in every way. I didn't like it particularly. I remember I still nurse the resentment that I was told by one particular teacher called Michael Lompriere. I like to name check him now. That I couldn't work on the school magazine because it was only for those who had a realistic prospect of getting into journalism.
Okay.
What a wanker. and I nurse that. I really do. I think... I also look at those teachers, those people who went into teaching in public schools thinking, you thought that was the best way to use your skills, to teach a lot of overprivileged, overachieving kids who would have been fine anywhere.
Yeah.
If you really cared about education, you'd have gone and tried to educate people who really needed you, but they didn't. Okay. Am I pandering to the audience? I mean that.
It feels like you came from a very close family reading the article I read recently about it, but having read quite a lot about it, it seems like a lot of young people feel abandoned by being sent to public school and then become prime minister.
I think that piece was specifically about boarding schools.
Yeah,
and I wasn't boarding. And I've always, you know, as a parent myself, you think, what is in your mind when you go, well, darling, you're 8 and you no longer need your parents, so fuck off. It is not at all strange that Boris Johnson is a weird, dysfunctional, fucked up twat. Because his parents said, we don't want you here anymore, go away.
Yeah, yeah.
That was cheap, wasn't it?
It was cheap, but it's, I mean, it's sort of interesting. I'm watching Succession, and you watch The Crown, and you see all these people in these amazingly privileged positions, and they're living, and admittedly one of those is complete fiction, but based on some people, maybe. And, you know, they get to a position of power, and there's no sort of affection and love, and it's all about maintaining
they
your
lack
position.
An emotional, you know.
I don't know if it's this rich people just trying to make us feel sorry for them, so we'll leave them alone, and they're actually having a very happy life. Or do you think those people are all kind of desperately unhappy?
I think they're all desperately unhappy deep down. I think they are you know, employment for therapists for decades to come.
Sure,
and Michael Gove as well.
Employment for Michael Gove.
No, I think what I mean is I don't think he went to a public school. Okay. I think he hates himself, but it doesn't matter if he doesn't, because the rest of us hate him anyway. So. Unless you love Michael Gove, in which case,
maybe somewhere in Norwich there's some love for. No. They've got the hand of a man in a jewel that they keep in a museum, and they can't love. They locked a girl in a house until she ate her parents, and even they can't love Michael Gove. Look, Jay, it's been lovely to have you. We're going to have to go because we've got another show to do, but absolutely delightful to meet you. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for the amazing Jay Rayner!
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll see you if you're coming for the next one. Bye.
You have been listening to The Hullustapper with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Jay Rayner. Thank you very much to Scant Regard for providing this music. I'm indebted to Chris Evans, not that one, for all his hard work in putting this together. I'm very much indebted to George, the incompetent sound man who travels all around the country recording these even when we can't film them. He's not all that incompetent, he's pretty good. He's letting us down. I am indebted to everyone at the Interlude Theatre and the Norwich Theatre. I've forgotten the name of the Norwich Theatre, which is ridiculous. You know who you are. Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted we managed to get these gigs done after having to postpone them once, twice, three times, whatever, however many times it was. This is a Sky Potato, the Norwich Playhouse. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz. If you don't think about it, it comes to you. That's what happens when you're my age. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Become a monthly badger, GoFasterStripe.com/badges. You get backstage interviews, you get stand-up shows for free. You get a badge and a membership card with a secret code on it. It's incredible. You get part 50% off the live streams of The Hullustapper. You get to find out who all the guests are first. You get ad-free podcasts. It's fucking insane. Why, it's £3 a month. You can pay more if you want, but it's well worth £3 a month. Even just for that saving on the live streams. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next week back at the Interlude Theatre in Norwich. My fan is free.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.